You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
I'm Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And the Velo News team of Matt Bowden.
Hello, Richard.
And Andy Hood.
Hello, fellas.
Now, Matt, normally on our Daily Telegraph podcast, Lionel describes where we are, but this is your patch, so perhaps you can describe where we are on this glorious rest day.
To tell the truth, we have no idea where we are. We've been kind of off the grid the last 2 days, yeah. Been taking wrong turns and trying to... our GPS has been malfunctioning. I know we're somewhere close to Bessasson in a lovely little village called Ornon, along... I'm not quite sure what the river is, to tell the truth, but it's a lovely part of France.
That was quite a lot of detail for someone who doesn't know where he is. It's a beautiful little market square. We're sitting outside having a Coke. Matt is having a beer because he's been out on his bike. I think you might be going on your bike later. And we're on the first rest day, and we'll talk a little bit later in the podcast perhaps about how rest days work for journalists. They're certainly not days of rest. They're days of frenzied activity and hard work. And Lionel, you and I have been at a couple of press conferences. I'm not sure about this pair. But we last did a Velo News podcast just on the eve of the tour with Andy. Matt, you've been a more recent arrival. When did you join the tour?
I flew in. I don't even know what. I've gotten totally native. I don't even know what day it is. I was in the tour for the first stage. I was in the Yorkshire Dales, I believe you guys call it. A couple days before the tour departed, I came over for a quite wonderful Rafa event, and then I just picked up the tour from there.
No advertising on the podcast, please, Matt. Although you are attired head to foot in Rafa gear there. If anybody, other clothing manufacturers listening, Matt is available for being signed to endorse their products.
I'm a little heavy right now, though.
I noticed that.
Okay, good. I was glad.
So listen, we're on the first rest day. We're reflecting on a stage yesterday that was certainly turned the tour on its head. Alberto Contador crashed and, as we've discovered later, broke his leg or suffered a fracture of his tibia. Andy, where does this leave the tour? You know Contador very well. You'll be getting very excited about the Vuelta, I think, because the Vuelta looks like it could be the Grand Tour of 2014. But where does it leave the tour? Is it Nibali's now to lose, do you think?
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment. I think Contador is the only menace, true menace, to Nibali's maillot jaune. I know he has Richie Porte and Valverde nipping in his heels. But Contador was really the only rider who had a team and the experience and the depth of motivation and ambition to really take it to Nibali. Nibali and Contador were the two guys I thought stood tall in this peloton in terms of their experience. They've won Grand Tours, they know what it takes, they're not a leader team. Without Contador, I can imagine the Kazakhs were putting the champagne on ice last night.
I mean, is there a fear that the other guys are going to be more interested in finishing on the podium than in trying to win the race? I'm talking about Richie Porte, Team Sky, Alejandro Valverde as well, and the French riders too, a few of them packing the top six now. What do you think, Matt?
No, I think this is still the biggest race in the world. I think guys, if they go out, they'd like to go out in a blaze of glory. And you know, I mean, I don't know the math on what third in the tour is worth. I mean, so it'd be hard for me to say if it's worth X amount of euros to you, then maybe you just want to ride for third. But I think, you know, you got a guy like Valverde. I mean, I don't think he's here for third. So, I mean, I think that the good guys will race hard, and those who are racing for points, I mean, they wouldn't have won anyway. So that's...
Well, interesting. We were at the Team Sky press conference this morning, and Dave Brailsford was chatting a little bit about how the rest of the race might unfold. And he spoke about Valverde and Movistar in particular, and he said he's an admirer of Movistar, the team. He likes the way that they race. They rip things up, and they're heading towards home territory in the Pyrenees, of course. But there was also the suspicion, I think, that the types of climbs in the Vosges are ones that suit Valverde, as Andy might agree with that. But what do you think, Movistar, are they here to win the race, or are they here to get Valverde on the podium? He's a Grand Tour winner as well, but he's never finished on the podium at the Tour.
Yeah, I think they're going to wait and see how the Alps play out. I think that from what I've understood of Valverde this whole season, he's been eyeing the Pyrenees. He thinks the Pyrenees will be won and lost. The Tour will be won and lost in the Pyrenees. So he obviously wasn't quite as sharp yesterday as perhaps he should have been, but he didn't lose too much time to Nibali. I still think that that a podium for both Richie and Valverde would be huge for those guys. And I think at a certain point, if they realize that Nibali is just that much stronger, they will start riding for the podium. But having said that, I think that Movistar and Valverde in the Pyrenees with thousands of Spanish fans on the road could set the stage for perhaps a big coup in this tour.
Can I just point out that Matt Bodin has just ordered the polka dot salad here. This is a huge plate of very ripe, very red tomatoes laid out almost like the polka dot jersey with a bit of goat's cheese on the top. Looks very nice. You have earned that. You've been out on your bike today.
To keep my trim physique, it's a climber's colours. I'm a climber in my head, at least.
It's a Joaquin Rodriguez tribute lunch, I think, there. He tweeted a very aesthetically pleasing tweet in honour of the fact that he's now in the polka dot jersey. It was a polka dot tweet, and he seemed pretty happy with that after his big escape on the stage to La Plonge des Belles Filles. I just want to ask Andy again about Valverde, because he's built his season around the Tour de France. He has been in terrific form all year, and my impression of the opening week of the Tour is that he's not been as sharp and as strong as he's been this season, and I wondered if this is because he's looking later in the race or because maybe his form has dipped a little bit. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Valverde dodged a bullet on the cobblestones. He got through that relatively well. He did crash once. He had to ride Rojas's bike, which was about 3 centimeters smaller than him, over the last 60K. I know Movistar is definitely happy where they are right now because, as you know, Valverde is always succumbs to some sort of travesty and some sort of setbacks. It cost him everything in the Tour. But I still think that there's more to come from Valverde. Maybe he's playing a little cat and mouse, not trying to show himself too much. I think the Pyrenees are ideal for him, so we'll just have to wait and see exactly how the race unfolds.
Andy Hood's a big Nairo Quintana guy. Just for the sake of argument, what do you think would happen if Quintana were here?
Well, the fact that he's not here is Valverde's big chance. And next year, Quintana is going to lead the Tour for Movistar. So this is Valverde's last chance. And there's rumors he's leaving the team anyway. So he's going to go, like you said, guns a-blazing. Well, if Quintana was here, you know, the Tour certainly wouldn't be over.
Oh, so you just said it. He just said the Tour's over. Tour's over?
So you think that if Quintana was here, he'd be leading the Tour, that he would have the beating of Nibali?
Well, no, I think if Quintana was in a position where, Valverde is now, there's no way he could say the race is over. I think Quintana is one of the few riders in the bunch who can just totally explode things. We saw that at the Giro, even last year at the Tour. And I think, personally, with Contador's exit last year, it might be the last we've seen of Contador. I mean, he fought so hard to get back to where he is at this point. We'll see if we ever see Contador. I mean, you know, he's a fighter. And we'll see how serious his injury is, but he'll be 32 next year. You got these young guys coming up. It's going to be hard for Contador to come back, and Valverde. I think this is like their last shot.
I mean, Contador, as you say, he's a fighter. Amazing to think that 2009 might have been his final Tour win then, because 2010, of course, he won the Tour. That he was stripped of that title after testing positive. But if he'd been told in 2009 this will be the last time this guy wins the Tour, which is possible now, you'd have been pretty shocked at that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think it just goes to show again, you know, how hard it is to win the Tour, how hard it is to win back-to-back tours, let alone several tours in a row. You look at Froome, you know, everyone thought Froome was going to just cakewalk through this Tour, and he's gone stage five. Contador's out, and Nibali has just been riding on silk. I mean, he is a solid bike handler, and those skills have obviously put him in the yellow jersey.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. We're in a beautiful market square somewhere in France, and the sun is shining. The sun shone, I think, for the first day on Monday at La Plonge des Belles Filles. It rained as well, but today there's hardly a cloud in the sky, and it really feels finally like the Tour de France. We're going to play out a little debate that I think the Velo News guys had over dinner. We're looking back on stage five, the cobbled stage, and I think there were quite strong feelings on both sides of the argument about whether that stage should be included in the Tour or not. Matt, I think you're in favour, and Andy Hood here, being the Spanish climber that he is, he's being a Spanish climbing sympathiser. I think you're against the cobble stage. Matt, first of all, why do you think the cobble stage belongs in the Tour?
Because I think the more specialized tours have become, the more specialized their riders have become. And I think that the Tour, you know, at least in the past couple of years, has come down to a calculation of watts per kilogram metric. How fast can you climb up a given hill? What's your steady state threshold? And that has decided the Tour. I mean, Froome, you know, last year, absolutely the best climber in the race, won the race by a lot, and then nobody was surprised with that. This year, you had the cobbled stage, and I think that it put an emphasis on being an all-around rider. Yes, there's an absolutely, Hoodie's going to say in a minute there, well, it just kind of takes it out of your hands, you know, there's too much of an element of chance. But I like that about that. You need to be in the right place at the right time, and I think that the cobbled stage really puts the emphasis on being where you need to be other than the front of a climb and riding your bike really, really well in strange, adverse, weird conditions.
Dude, you've got a very hard case to follow there. That I feel quite convinced about the cobbles you've got to
talk. First of all, just set the record. So I am a pavé pervert. I love the pavé. I love Paris-Roubaix. I love all the Flandrian week. Love it. I love it in April. I think it just distracts from the Tour. I agree with a lot of what everyone says. It's part of being a bike racer. You should be able to handle the pavé, etc. But I also think that the pavé stage in this Tour just took so much out of the fight. I mean, of course, we still have the race. Nothing's decided. But people are saying, well, Froome didn't even make it to the cobbles. But I think Chris Froome, in a large part, was eliminated because the cobbles were looming. The fight and all the crashes on that stage came on the approach and the positioning to the cobbles sections. In fact, there were very few crashes on the actual pavé because it was so wet and muddy. Only riding the crown, no one could ride. And also, I think there's 10, 15, maybe 20 guys in the world who can really race on the pavé. Maybe 10 of those guys were at the Tour, and maybe 5 of them actually had ambitions to ride that stage to win, whereas the rest of the guys, it was just a crapshoot, survival of the fittest, really just luck. And I think that the Tour got very lucky that day. They could have easily lost Contador, they lost Froome, they could have lost a few other guys. Nibali could have taken 5 minutes on everybody. I just think it's more, you know, it's a cheap thrill. How did I put it there? It came out better when I had a few glasses of rosé in me, but a cheap thrill for very little long-term payback.
I feel conflicted now. I can see both sides of the argument. I think Pavé Pervert would make a great Twitter account. look out for that. It might not be Andy Hood behind it, though. But no, I can see both sides of the argument. I think the revelation of the day was Vincenzo Nibali, and we do know him as a great bike handler, of course, and on the descents. And I spoke to one of his teammates, Louis Westra, today at the Astana press conference. He spoke about the skill of being able to handle your bike on a slippery descent being similar to the skill of handling your bike on the pavé. It's transferable skill. And you know, Daniel Freeb, who is a regular on our other podcast, talks a lot about bike riding, professional racing being, as you say, about more than a test of ability to climb watts. It's about, you know, if you've got the full package, you're talking about bike handling skills. Froome's crash before the pavé arguably was the one that put him out the day before, when he injured his wrist and I think started the next day nervous, not able to handle his bike as well as he should have done. So I feel a bit conflicted. Lionel, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Matt, and I'm going to give the debate to Matt, because it's only once every 4, 5, 6 years that they put the cobbles in the Tour de France. They are roads in France, perfectly legitimate to include them. I agree with some of Andy's points about it being a cheap thrill, but what a thrill it was. I mean, it's a day that we will remember for many, many years, and the next time the cobbles are put in the Tour in maybe, I don't know, 2018 or 2020 or whenever they put them in, we'll look back at this stage and remember Stage 5 of the Tour, won by Lars Boom, the day that Nibali potentially won the Tour. I mean, he you can't take away from the fact that it is likely that the most significant chunk of time that Nibali gains in this entire Tour is on that cobbled stage. So, you know, fair game, I think.
And I think if Contador had still been in the race, that might have been the stage that won him the Tour, if he did go on and win the Tour. And it was a plan, you know, it was a brilliantly executed plan by Astana. Now, you mentioned, in your argument, Matt, the Tour, certainly last year with Chris Froome, the year before as well, Bradley Wiggins, was almost like a ramp test. It was, you know, played out on the open road. It was a case of who could climb the best, and this led to lots of debates, discussion about riders' physical capabilities on climbs and whether certain performances were suspicious, whether doping was an explanation. And interestingly, this morning at the Team Sky press conference, which was far less well attended than the last couple of years, because Richie Porte is second, and I don't think people see him as a likely winner. I think he's certainly a podium contender. But at the end of it, Dave Brailsford asked the journalists why there were no questions about doping this year to them, because the last 2 years their press conference had been dominated by questions about doping, and he couldn't really understand why having a guy in second should sort of deter those questions. Where has that discussion gone, he wondered. He was also curious that whether, you know, Vincenzo Nibali in the yellow jersey was being asked these questions, not, as he pointed out, because he has any suspicions, just because that was the big question, the big discussion the last couple of years. Why is it not this year?
This is sort of a dangerous subject for me, for anyone, really.
For anyone.
For anyone, for all of us. I think that there's a certain degree of nationalism when it comes to the press at the Tour de France and the riders from, you know, a writer's given area that he or she is from and that he or she covers. So I think that has a little bit to do with it. There's obviously the language difference. Maybe as English-speaking journalists, it's easier for us to ask the questions of Sky. And then somebody else, this wasn't my idea, I can't recall whom I'm channeling here. It could be one of you at this table, maybe even Andrew Hood next to me. Somebody said that because Sky cracked the door open and didn't shy away from addressing the doping issue, and they've said, hey, we are a quote unquote, like other teams have said, we're a clean team, you know, that's what we are, we have zero tolerance, you know, and then they addressed it in the first place, then it sort of kicked a snowball off the top of a mountain, and it just kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I will say, you know, when you have a guy like Froome and you have a second rest day, and Froome last year has been so dominant, it's been so consistent, so thorough in his sort of taking apart of the peloton, it does, you know, it looks like how can that guy be that much better than everybody else? So it's a natural question, I think, for us to ask, especially in the sort of post EPO era, if you want to call it that.
Andy, over to you.
Well, yeah, that's something we were talking about, how I think Sky generates these doping questions because they're willing to talk about it. They answer the questions, so just people ask more questions. He asked Contador a doping question. He goes, siguiente pregunta. He won't even answer the question. And if you do ask him that question, it's the whole game we used to play back in the day. You ask the doping questions, you don't get invited back to the press rooms or to the press conferences or what have you. I would also think, Matt and I were talking about this when we were at the Giro this year, driving around in Italy. It's a cultural divide, too, I think. The Anglo countries have a different attitude about forgiveness, about letting people move on from the past sins, where I think in some countries, like in America or perhaps in the UK, it's like if you're a doper and a sinner, you're a doper and a sinner for the rest of your life. It doesn't matter what you do to come back and to try to regain the trust of someone. You look at Pantani. Pantani is revered as a god in Italy. He's on the posters of the Cima Pantani in the Italian culture. There's no sort of stigma attached to Pantani, but I really have a hard time imagining someday there'll be a Cima Lance Armstrong anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, it's Vincenzo Nibali should say he was one of the few Italian riders really who, when he did begin to emerge, did talk about doping and you know, came out against doping, as radical as that sounds. But he began to emerge, I suppose, in the shadow a little bit of Ivan Basso, and when Basso was having his problems and serving his ban, Nibali made some pretty strong public pronouncements about doping. There's not any kind of whiff of suspicion around him. I think his career trajectory is quite believable, and I think we as journalists fed back to Dave Brailsford that the issue perhaps around Sky was the fact that for a lot of people Chris Froome seemed to come from nowhere, and that And that he was winning the tour, that it was the first tour post the Armstrong fall. And I think that was sort of a perfect storm. I think what you say, Matt, is absolutely spot on. I mean, Astana have never sort of set themselves up as an anti-doping team. I mean, that's a team that's got quite a long history now. Came into the sport on the back of a doping scandal. They came in to replace Liberty Seguros in 2006. You know, Liberty Seguros pulled out on the eve of the 2006 tour, scared off by the scandal that had attached itself to the team. Astana came in to replace it. I think Vinokourov was behind that sort of consortium of sponsors that took over the team. And of course, a year later, Vinokourov himself he tested positive at the tour and was kicked off, and the team followed him. So, you know, they've got a pretty ropey history there. But I asked Louis Westra about, you know, doping, anti-doping, and what the team's sort of policy was, and clearly he wasn't that comfortable talking about it in a way that Sky actually are. And it is one of the ironies that, you know, they get accused of a lack of transparency and so on, when actually we as journalists find quite a lot of openness in that team, I think. And I think you spoke to Alexander Vinokourov, didn't you, Lionel? Well, I think we'll be playing that on our podcast with The Telegraph tomorrow, but can you tell us briefly what he said?
Well, yeah, just to back up what Matt said, really, it's the language issue certainly for an English language podcast. It's even harder than for, at least if you're doing something for print, you can translate and convey what was said. But the Astana press conference today, not a single question about doping directed to Nibali, who's sitting there between Michele Scarponi, who's been suspended for 2 years at some point for doping, and Alexander Vinokourov, the team boss, effectively suspended for 2 years for doping, and yet no questions directed to any of them about the culture of the team, about the health of the sport at the moment, about the history of the team, and whether at what point that's changed. And so the difficulty recording some audio for the podcast that we'll play later in the week is it's not Alexander Vinokourov is trying to convey his thoughts in probably his third or fourth language. And he did say, you know, we are a clean team and that cycling has changed an awful lot in the last 5 to 7 years. And of course, he should know, in a way, you know, he should know exactly what cycling was like, certainly from his point of view and his team 5 to 7 years ago, because that was the time when he was busted for blood transfusions. So it's tough. We were talking about what purpose it serves asking the questions in the press conferences, or even just one-to-one, as Vinokourov and I did today. What are you hoping to achieve other than to just shine the light and see whether it shows anything up? And it will be interesting if Nibali dominates and is really impressive through the Alps and the Pyrenees, whether those questions gather momentum a bit, because, you know, as much as we don't want to lump the press pack together as one kind of, a mass of people that all think with one brain, because we don't. There's a lot of different agendas and motivations, nationalities, people chasing different stories. It may well be that by the second rest day, when basically the race has had the same person in the yellow jersey for a fortnight, that people will be looking for another angle on the Tour de France. It'll be interesting to see what comes up then.
Well, it is sometimes the dominant story when there's nothing else to talk about, and when the guy in yellow is there facing the press every day. But I think there is some value in putting the doping question to the guy in yellow, but there are diminishing returns with it as well, and we saw it with Chris Froome last year, that just asking essentially the same question day after day doesn't actually really get you anywhere. That's not journalism. Asking a question in a press conference isn't journalism. Journalism is trying to find things out, and I question whether you do really find anything out from asking somebody in a press conference, "Are you clean?"
Right. Well, that was what I was thinking when you said you were at Astana today, and there was no questions about doping. Whereas, you know, if we look at the Sky pressers last year, there was plenty of questions about doping. So, the question is, are we not doing our jobs if we're not asking about doping? Right? Because I think that under this lens of social media, people want to see that the journalists are being the attack dogs that they imagine that we all are, when essentially, you know, and we're not all that way. We can't be that way all the time, otherwise you lose your access, you lose your sort of credibility as somebody to tell anything other than one story. So I guess I would ask all of you guys, is it a question that we have to ask, or do you think it's a question that we have to ask when the situation forces our hand?
Well, I think it's an interesting context in terms of how the sport has changed, because back in the day, when they were perhaps all doping, would you ask the question when you know you're going to get lied to? And now when you ask the question that you think you know that the answer has changed. I mean, I think we've had private conversations with riders, on the record or off the record, that are more telling and more valuable as getting the story, understanding what's actually happening inside the peloton, where the sport's going. And that is tremendous service and good journalism. Yeah, but stand up sometimes and say, are you doping? Yeah, you want to get someone on the record to deny it, or, you know, of course, they're not going to say that they are. I've never seen anybody raise their hand and say, you know what, actually, guys, I haven't told anybody else, but I'm going to tell you, I am actually doped to the gills. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say that. They're very forward after they get thrown in jail, but that hasn't happened for a long time. The sport has changed. I think there is a place, a space for those kinds of questions, and I think that, you know, the sport's done a terrible job, I think, handling the whole issue of the doping within the peloton, both from the teams, from the riders, from the UCI, from the race. You know, it's still this big cloud that's hanging over the sport. Has the sport changed? We think it has, but there's a lot of evidence that they're bungling the fight against doping as well. And that's where I think it's an important place to ask questions.
Just a point on you talk about the riders getting thrown in jail, or, you know, a little bit of an exaggeration, because not many went to jail, although Alexander Vinokourov spent an afternoon in the cells in 2007. I think he did, didn't he? Was taken away. But the police aren't showing the same interest in cycling and the Tour de
Ramunas,
France.
What was his name? Ramunas' wife was in jail for 3 months. Back in the 2003 Tour or whatever that was. But go ahead.
I mean, I think it's not a case of, you know, should you ask the question? You should be prepared to ask the question, I think, but not repeat it every single day. And I think one of the other things you can do as a journalist is have conversations with writers that you can't always report, that inform what you write and what you think, but also get to know the other staff on the team. You know, this is something we have learned from the Lance Armstrong era, I suppose, is how key to it all the support staff are, the doctors, the medical staff, the soigneurs, even mechanics and people like that. You know, get to know these people as much as you can, speak to them, and they can be you would think that if there was doping happening on a sort of organized level, then the doctor would know about it. And so, you know, we've had this conversation with David Walsh, who obviously played a big part in investigating Lance Armstrong, and his whole approach, his journalistic approach, being to get to know people, to form impressions of them, opinions about them. That's an essential part of, I think, of being a journalist. Now, you might get people wrong, but all you can do is really try your best in that regard.
I agree with a lot of that, but don't you think it's dangerous when we are assessing other human beings in our heads and saying, look, I trust this person, I don't trust that person, I have a good feeling, I have a bad feeling? Because how often are all of us wrong about all these things when it comes to our professional lives, you know, personal lives, anything like that? You know, we get character judgments wrong all the time. So it's difficult to dress it all down.
You don't stop trying to make them. You know, I mean, you know, if you're in a relationship and somebody cheats on you, and, you know, that can happen easily, and you know, that's somebody you've been very, very close to and you think that you know, and it turns out you don't know them. Doesn't mean you're not going to form another relationship with somebody else and trust them all over again. And, you know, some people will let you down, some people will lie to you, some people will be very convincing, but you have to hope that not everybody's like that, don't you, Matt?
This just took a very serious turn. You do have to hope that. We all have to hope for more, right? We have to hope for the best. We have to hope for the best in people.
Having,
we have to hope for the best in the sport.
It's been interesting having these conversations with guys, you know, both on and off the record. The feedback that I'm getting is how, you know, they say that they police themselves within the peloton. I had an interview with David Miller this year. You know, David is leading the sport, and I was asking him, you know, how the sport had changed since he was around. Of course, he was one of the bad boys back in the day. He was kind of leading the fight to help change the peloton. And he's saying, like, last year when Sandon Brogio was testing positive at the Giro, they were calling the UCI even before he tested positive, saying, you know, this guy's on the fast gas. You know, we need to get him out of our race. So there's this kind of auto-policing that goes on, supposedly, which I kind of believe. You see, the race is so different. Like, this race, this tour to me, is so much more exciting than any of the doped up tours. I mean, every day it is completely just blown up. It's incredible, actually, how even the other day in the crosswinds going into, what was it, Nancy, or the peloton just completely blew up. You never saw that happen back in the day, in the first week of a tour.
Let's compare the cobbled stage this year. Sorry to bring that back to that, the discussion back to Andy. And we're going to, in the next part, talk about the American riders in the race. But the cobbled stage this year compared to 2004 when US Post drilled it and, you know, gained a lot of time for Armstrong, eliminated Iban Mayo, who'd crashed. They took advantage of circumstances. Astana, the other day, and we do see this a lot, they went into that race with a plan, a strategy, which was to put Louis Oester in the break, to have Fuglsang and Nibali right up behind. And there was a lot of thinking that went into that, an imaginative plan. And we're seeing that. We saw that a lot last year at the Tour with Movistar, with Garmin Sharp. And those sorts of strategies, those sorts of battle plans, they weren't really part of the game in the mass doping era, were they?
No, they certainly weren't. Back in the day, they would just put in the big ring and attack with three climbs to go and ride the big ring over or category climb. The sport has changed dramatically in that regard. Now the attacks come 3K from the summit.
You're listening to the Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
The Velo News Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Matt Bowden is polishing off his polka dot salad. Only a few red dots to go there, Matt. I don't know if you're going to manage those, but you've done really well. You deserve that. Let's talk about the American riders in the race. TJ Van Garderen, Andrew Talansky, both began with great hopes. Van Garderen had a very nasty crash on the road into Nancy, and just near the front of the bunch, very similar to Chris Froome's crash on the Tuesday, where he just sort of fell when he seemed to be well positioned. Van Garderen went down heavily, lost about a minute that day, but he's climbed right back into contention, and I think he's been looking better and better. Have you spoken to him much, Matt? Do you know much about Van Garderen, Andy? Matt's shaking his head. Andy,
we've kind of split up our beat duties here. He's on the Talansky beat. I'm the Van Garderen boy. Yeah, TJ, I think, is still right in there in the hunt for the podium. He was pretty disappointed, both on the cobbles. He crashed twice that day. He actually had some quite pointed comments about the fact that the cobbles didn't really deserve to be in the Tour. And also he had that bad crash.
Leave it, Andy.
Yeah.
Move on. Right, forget about the cobbles.
I think we established a winner in that discussion.
And then he had that nasty crash again in Nancy. Luckily, wasn't seriously injured. He was right there yesterday behind Port, trying to stay close on Nibali's wheel. I think now Van Garderen's actually in a good place, because getting into these longer alpine climbs, going into the Pyrenees, the roads are going to open up. I think the tension's going to go away from the peloton. There'll be breakaways. People are getting tired. The fight positioning won't be nearly as intense as it has been the first half of this tour. And I think TJ is going to get stronger as this tour goes on, and he has that final time trial waiting in Bergerac. You know, I still think there's podium hopes for Van Garderen.
What do you think about the BMC racing tactic on that day into Nancy? Because Van Garderen crashed with, what was it, 20 k's to go, something like that, and then while he's still chasing on with a few teammates, one of his other teammates, Greg Van Avermaet, putting the pressure on at the front of the race. And Richard and I kind of disagreed a bit about this, because he didn't think that Van Avermaet, by accelerating at the front of the race, was putting Van Garderen in any more jeopardy, because he wasn't catching up anyway, and it was only going to be a handful of seconds. But from the outside, it looked like an odd tactic. It looked like the team was kind of divided in half a bit there. Not everybody's on the Van Garderen plan. Do you know much about that?
Yeah, they talked about that a little bit. They just said that, I think it was about 15K to go, the race was on, Van Avermaet was chasing the win. And if he sets up, I don't think that really changes the outcome of that breakaway. That breakaway was quite large. And I think that going into this race, the riders had the freedom to try on certain days, and that was certainly one of his days to go for the stage win. And I think the team seems pretty much solidly behind Van Garderen, and they've built this team around him. It's all of TJ's guys are on this team with BMC. You know, obviously they put Kendall Evans out to pasture, or perhaps it's a better way to say that, but you know, TJ is their man for BMC now and in the future. So they're building this team around TJ, not only for this tour, but for the next two or three years.
And what about Andrew Talansky? Because he had an quite an eventful finish to the stage in Nancy. He Was that the same day? That was the same day, wasn't it? When he crashed into Simon Gerrans and
Simon Gerrans crashed into him. That's the big question,
phrasing, isn't it? Well, Talansky certainly blamed Gerrans for that, and was demanding an apology when he went back to the bus. What was your view of that, and what's the fallout been? Because it does seem that in the last couple of days, the crashes for Talansky have hampered him.
I mean, he crashed hard two times over the same amount of days, so the physiological impacts of that are absolutely enormous. I mean, I spoke with Garmin director Charlie Wagelius yesterday on the phone after Andrew. I think he lost about 10 minutes yesterday up the Planche de Belfi. And Charlie, straight shooter, you know, good guy. He was real honest about it. He said, hey, listen, you know, recovering from a crash like that and attacking and accelerating in a bike race are two things that aren't compatible. You know, your body's trying to rebuild itself. It's suffering. I mean, it's repairing things, and you can't really go out and put it on the rivet and expect to stay with a guy like Vincenzo Nibali, who's, you know, trying to win the Tour de France on that day. So Garmin, on the first day after his two crashes, got fairly lucky in that it was a pretty managed race. You know, I mean, things went a little haywire at the end there, but yesterday, I mean, there was going to be no hiding yesterday, and you know, we just saw that he didn't quite have it. As far as the Gerrans crash, which you asked about, the Talansky-Gerrans dust-up, I think it was an unfortunate confluence of factors for Talansky in that he was trying to get out of a bunch sprint, whereas Gerrans was trying to get into a sprint, and he looked over the wrong shoulder. Sure, say it, but Gerrans, if you look at the tape frame by frame, definitely was coming toward him too, so I think it was just, you know, I think it was bound to happen in the situation. I don't necessarily want to say any guy is at fault there, but certainly Talansky got the worst of it as Gerrans went on to finish upright. So
Talansky, I spoke to Charlie Wagelius after the first crash in Nancy and at the stage starting next day, and he said it looked bad, but he wasn't actually that badly hurt then, and he was still confident that he could, you know, contend for something. But has that second crash really knocked him out? And what can he get out of this tour now?
Well, we're not sure what he could get out of this tour now. I mean, you're never sure. No matter what anyone says, you're never sure what anyone can get out of a tour, of course. But Garmin Sharp had a rest day today, and they called it a, quote, full rest day. So, you know, there was no press conference. Andrew didn't talk to the media. And he hasn't, you know, he actually hasn't spoken much after the stages, after the crashes, which, you know, I think fair play to Garmin. I think you can't necessarily expect a young rider like that to come out and maybe say the right things in those situations. And, you know, sure, we expect to talk to him, but it's definitely not, I guess, maybe part of the job for a guy like that at this point in his career. 10 years later, you'll be fully expected to come out and talk to the media and give a rundown. But so I don't think we actually know what Garmin can hope for. Charlie told me yesterday they were going to evaluate expectations for the tour today. We assume they're doing that. But at this point, you have to think Talansky would try to get into a breakaway, try to win a stage. I mean, he's, what is he, 14 minutes down on GC, roughly. So they'll let him go up the road a bit. I don't think he's going to be watched. Of course, they'll note his Dauphiné victory, but, you know, this is the tour. There's a lot more minutes to deal with here. So I would bet he comes out, tries to win a mountain stage. I mean, I think that'd be a success for them.
Do you know anything about, just on still Talansky and Garmin Sharp, do you know anything about the future of that team? Rumors about a merger with Cannondale. Have you heard anything sort of concrete on that?
I only know what I hear when I'm driving the car. I believe Andrew Hood did a story about the murky waters of the mergers, but we should ask him.
Well, Vaudis is assured that there is indeed a team next year. We asked him what the names would be in the jersey. He said he can't say at this point because the names in the jersey change every year. Because what's important is I have a team. There is a lot of this talk of Cannondale coming over as a bike sponsor, Cervelo moving out. Question is, what happens to Cannondale's team license? It's musical chairs. This happens like this year in the Tour. Belkin has an uncertain future. Giant Shimano said they have a 4-year deal with Giant Shimano. There was a lot of rumors that team was on the bubble as well. But what's important is that Vaudis said the team's moving forward and they're building. They just extended Talansky's contract for 2 more years.
So Jonathan won't be paying that out of his own pocket, which will be a relief to him. We have a big new German sponsor announced today, Bora, taking over NetApp and Jura, who are both pulling out. So that's good news. For 5 years they've signed up for, and it sounds like that will be a bigger team. Maybe they'll be able to bring a proper bus next year, because they're the only team without a proper bus. They've got a sort of quite a nice looking camper van, but a camper van nonetheless.
Yes, I think it's a huge boon for German cycling. You know, they literally, this, the media there kind of abandoned the sport after the Ulrich telecom scandals, and you know, the tour's not broadcast on the through the air German TV. The rumor is that it will be coming back next year. You guys got a Kittel, Tony Martin, Degenkolb, all these guys coming up, the new clean generation. I mean, Germany is the biggest single market in Europe. Everyone talks about expanding cycling in all these international markets. Like, bring Germany back into the sport and you come out way ahead in Europe.
Absolutely. Let's just finish off this podcast by describing a little bit about what happens on a rest day. Matt, your bike ride isn't really typical. I can count on one hand the number of times I've heard of journalists going for bike rides on rest days, so I tip my hat to you, really. You have my full admiration.
I can't tell if you're serious. Is he serious?
Yeah, I think he's serious, yeah. I once brought a bike to the Tour de France, and it didn't come out of the car.
Well, I believe you have to strike while the iron's hot, see. So, here we are. It's a rest day. We get to our hotel. I notice that there's a couple empty hours that I'd like to fill. So I jump on the bike, I go for a ride, and I clear my head. I don't know if it's a quantifiable effect here, right? Like, I don't know if my story will be better when I read it tonight, but certainly I think, as a journalist, you need to step back from the race sometimes and see it for what it is, and it is a beautiful bike race, and you need to appreciate that and hold it in your hands and sort of contextualize it as an admirer of sport, you know, as an admirer of the whole sort of human struggle that the Tour de France can be. And if you're, you know, in the scrum all day, every day, it's sometimes it can be really hard to do that. And I told Andy when we were riding around today in the car, I said, I don't want to come over here and in 5 years hate the Tour de France, because it's beautiful, it's a wonderful event, you know. And I think sometimes it works out if you can steal a couple hours away and think to yourself about France, about the bike race, about exactly what it is to experience it. And sometimes it doesn't work out so well, and you end up a mountain pass over from where you think you're supposed to be, and you're 4 hours late, and then you don't do that again for a whole year. So
I think it's a testament to your organization skills, because one of the things about the tour is that the time just does get swallowed up by this huge machine that is the Tour de France. And it's hard on stage days, but it's also hard on rest days, because on rest days there's an awful lot going on, and you can spend the day rushing around trying to be everywhere and do everything. A big factor on a rest day is the old FOMO, the fear of missing out, that something newsworthy is happening elsewhere. And again, we've referred a few times in this podcast to the doping years, or the doping scandal years, where you know, every rest day there'd be some doping story breaking somewhere, somebody would test positive, or there'd be some news conference where the question generated some kind of interesting responses. And it was very hard, and it is very hard to be everywhere and to cover everything. And
well,
so
let me jump in here. I think it's a curious reflection of how the media's changed just over the last couple of years, really with the advent of Twitter. Everything is instantaneous now, and Twitter is a big way that people can communicate. Because back in the day, it was the big fight to go to every press conference, to get all these quotes, to publish them out onto the internet. It was a race between all the websites to try to get out there first. Now, it's instant. People, you know, the writers are twittering, the teams are twittering, journalists are twittering during press conferences. The news is instantaneous. Teams are also doing a much better job about getting information out to journalists, to the media, to the public. And it kind of lets journalists be kind of journalists again, in the sense of going after deeper stories, going after contextual pieces and analysis and stories like that have a little more depth to them. But even yesterday, the whole story that was flaring up on Twitter yesterday was the Contador's bike. I mean, that was like one of these Twitter frenzies where everyone's speculating, jumping to conclusions about what actually happened. And in the end, you just had to ask the old-fashioned questions, like, you know, what the hell did happen? But Twitter now is a go-to source for news, good and bad, which I think we saw yesterday. Sometimes people getting the wrong information, making the wrong conclusions off Twitter.
It was striking, actually, how on the race the story of Contador's bike mattered so much less to people who had seen pictures of the bike on Twitter, or I don't even know if those pictures made it onto TV. It was a story that almost was generated on Twitter, and people had, you know, the old joke about the lie getting twice around the block before the truth had even got his pants on. That was a real kind of story that typified that phrase, really.
Pants mean a different thing in the US. This is a US podcast, so pants.
Underpants.
Underpants. Yeah, I thought it was only me that wasn't interested. I just wasn't that interested in the Contador bike story. The guy had fallen off. He was out the tour. That for me was the story, not what had caused it. Really, I couldn't really. I thought, am I missing something here? Second time I've had that feeling this week, because I also had that feeling about the Denis Menchov story, where the UCI did release the information that Denis Menchov had been sanctioned for biological passport violations, and he's been retired a year. The important thing I felt with the Menchov case is that he has been punished. He has been found guilty of doping, and he has been punished. And for me, the way that that's announced is of secondary importance, but a distant second to the fact of the punishment.
Well, just before Matt jumps in, I completely agree with you. I mean, it was announced by the UCI in a standard bulletin. And because Menchov is a bigger name, what were they supposed to do? Put it in a bigger font size, or, you know, like put it in red?
14 point, at least, I think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people want kind of a due process from the UCI. They want a transparency. It's a bit like, you know, we were talking about how kind of government works back in the UK, where, you know, the politicians are talking in the Houses of Parliament, and I'm sure it's the same in America as well. And the media kind of picks up on the stories, but it doesn't mean that all of that business isn't in the public domain somewhere. You just have to know where to look. So, I mean, it's not like the UCI has tried to hide anything by announcing Denis Menchov has been sanctioned. And in actual fact, we should be moving towards an era where every rider is dealt with in the same way. You know, and they shouldn't be preferential treatment just because one person is a bigger name. That's kind of the media's job, to amplify the things that matter more.
Right, yeah, and I, too, was lackadaisical about the Menchov news. And then I thought about it a little bit more, and I thought, you know, this is important that it's announced. It's important that things are done retroactively, even if it's, you know, even if it looks bad for the sport in the short term. The long-term view here is that, you know, if you cheat and you are caught years later, you will be punished and your name will be dragged through the mud on some level, you know, by the cycling media or the bigger media. And I think that we can only hope that that has a chilling effect, because, you know, sort of like cops and robbers, right? Like, the bad guys are always ahead of the good guys, just 1, 2, 3 steps. So, you know, I'm not saying, what am I saying? If there's something going on now and there's not a test for it and we don't know about it, but if the guys who may be doing it see that you'll get caught and you're, you know, your materials can be tested years later, and that they can maybe find what's been happening, if anything has happened now down the line, you know, we can only hope that it has, I guess, what you'd call a chilling effect on the current generation of riders.
And it's, you know, the UCI is the governing body. They're supposed to be dispassionate. It's our job to drag Denis Menchov's name through the mud now. That's our job. We will do that. We will destroy his reputation because he's been convicted of doping. That's not the UCI's job. Anyway, we should wrap it up there. If you're going to read one writer on this Tour de France, it should obviously be Matt Boden, because he has managed to pull his head out of the machine for a bit by riding his bike. And Andy, you're going to do that later, so that's another writer that you should read on the Tour de France.
Two,
right? Two, that's it.
He rides twice as far as I do, so...
Yeah, both essential... essential reads. So velonews.com. What's the Twitter handle? @velonews.
Yes,
so find these guys there. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Matt and Andy. We'll be back for our third Velonews podcast in about a week, I think, on the next rest day, 6 days or so. But thank you very much for just now.
Yes, we certainly appreciate it.
Thank you, fellas.